Rob Wolf, Andy D is back with episode 34 of the Paleolithic Solution. What's going on?
Dude, I feel like it's episode 68 after I got chewed up and spat out at jiu-jitsu class today.
Yeah, as I mentioned to Rob earlier, I think he's going to get skinnier by the day. That's my anticipation.
I counter that with the fact that I'm eating a lot more food now. My metabolic rate is up, but Andy likes to tear me down at any chance. He
has, so. Hey, I saw those pictures on Facebook comparing Jim Wendler to Brad Pitt, so I know
that. Really, at the end of the day, I think I would take Brad Pitt and snatch over Wendler anyway. Like, as much as I travel, trying to stick 275 pounds of my ass on a plane would be bad news. So.
Yes, I think the Brad Pitt from Snatch is certainly more attractive and appropriate in most situations, although I can think of a few you'd rather be Jim Wendler. It's a whole other situation.
True enough, yeah. If you could just put on an alternate between Brad Pitt and Jim Wendler, you could probably do pretty good. So
exactly. What's going on with the book? What's status?
Book is getting close. Erish, my publisher, is going to come and hang out. Like, the, you know, obviously these podcasts were actually a little bit ahead of time. So early July, he's going to be here and basically camped out in the house. And we're going to hammer out some final editing, make sure that all the charts and graphs and bells and whistles are done. We have a number of photos that we need to take for the exercise and movement chapter, but it's getting close. It's getting super close. We apparently have a finalized book cover finally, or at least theoretically. So I'm going to do a blog post on that and actually kind of trace a little bit of the evolution of the the book cover. It's kind of funny because at one point, the very, very helpful Tuttle Publishing people, who I'm totally indebted for their help and the time that they put into the project. But it's really funny. They essentially, at one point, created an identical version of the Paleo Diet cover for my book. And I'm kind of like, okay, guys, I get that, certain color schemes work and certain typefaces work and everything, but I, in fact, cannot steal the cover off of my professor's book. That would probably be bad. And they were like, oh, okay, yeah. But it was just kind of a funny gig. Like, these guys, collectively, like, the group of people probably had literally like 60, 65 years of collective, like, book sales, marketing, developing books and all that. So, like, a ton of very savvy people. And I'm an idiot on marketing and all that sort of jive. So, like, obviously my first efforts on the cover were not really what would be good for a mainstream deal. But these folks in some ways are so mainstreamed that everything kind of converges into, like, one flavor. You know, it's kind of chocolate, vanilla, strawberry kind of gig, and that's kind of it. But also there's just this reality that when you're dealing with a mass market scenario, that if you do something too far off the beaten path, like, folks are just going to ignore it. Like, the criticism initially was that my book, like, it looked like an anthropology cover and that people would never make the connection that it was a diet, health, fitness related and all that. And so you kind of have to acquiesce to that stuff. So it's interesting. It's been a interesting process, very stressful, because I don't understand marketing, image, any of that stuff, obviously by, like, me and my website and the whole thing, I just have not put a lot of polish into that stuff, and I'm gonna have to step my game up at some point. But it was cool. It's cool. It's getting close, though.
Well, I'm voting for that printing number two has you topless on the cover. A la Sean Phillips with the abs diet. That's what I want to see, really.
I'm thinking more Jim Carrey from In Living Color wearing the bikini and, like, the female bodybuilder thing would be more my shtick. But we'll see. We'll see.
That would sell.
You can bet on almost anything in Vegas, so you can get a pool going on that, and we'll see how it goes.
We'll see what I can cook up. All right, man. Good. Well, it's good to know we're still making progress, Rob, and that after 5 years, you will release a book. I'm very excited for you.
Oh, you're baiting me there. You're baiting me. You're trying to bait me into something that I already maybe, we won't even get into that. Someday we'll tell that story. But Andy Dees is baiting me, folks, trying to get me in trouble.
No, not at all. But you folks will have to know that every time Rob Wolf says he's so busy, I throw him some, like, blog post from Mike Boyle or somebody, how busy they are, just to rile him up as well. So, it's all in fun, Rob. It's only because I love you.
Boyle ghostwrites all his stuff. No, I'm just kidding. Boyle's awesome.
You're going to start a whole new problem. All right. So anyway.
Oh, dude, I know.
For First question from our good friend Christina. So this is kind of
this is Christina from NorCal. So she is second only to Katie DeLuca in number of questions.
Locally, no one has beaten Derek Locally. Yet.
Beaten Derek.
Okay. So this is about her boyfriend Matt's aunt been paleo last 5 weeks, having problems with her muscles freezing. We'll kind of jump down. So basically, she eats a pretty good paleo diet now. She's on hormone replacement, bioidentical hormones. She takes 500 milligrams magnesium, probiotics, multivitamin, calcium, and glucosamine. Christina recommended that she add vitamin D3, fish oil, and ditch the multivitamin. Her workout schedule is one bike ride 25 miles a week, weights 2 to 3 times a week for up to an hour, and she spins basically 3 times a week. So three major issues. Number one, she's got some digestive backing up going on. Christina told her to ditch the chia seeds that she's eating and the smooth mood laxative tea and switch to Now Super Enzymes. And she kind of gave her the spiel about taking it with fat and protein, increasing until she feels warmth, and then decreasing the dosage. She's been off smooth mood tea, but don't know if she's picked up some super enzymes. So what's your thoughts on this first part, Rob?
This part, actually, when we get down to the muscle freezing part, it actually kind of links into that more. So maybe we'll save even commentating. Part of what she has going on here could be, when we look at the rest of the stuff she has going on, makes sense from kind of like a mineral metabolism issue, like a calcium magnesium absorption and utilization perspective. And so maybe we'll tackle that after the third one.
All right, I like it. All right, so question two. She's wanting to get rid of that last stubborn pounds around the midsection. Christina recommended she cut out fruit for 30 days and see how she feels. Could she possibly add a fat, avocado, coconut oil, et cetera, to her eating schedule at the same time?
With this one, definitely ditching the fruit is a good plan, even if she's doing a little bit more of like this starchy yam or sweet potato scenario, then that makes sense. Like it sounds kind of preposterous. I was reading some Martin Berkham stuff the other day, and like those guys are super cool. I dig a lot of their work, but they get very down on some of like the fructose management and stuff like that. But it really matters for people on this whole leaning out process. Like you can really go kind of isocaloric kind of fruit versus yams, and people doing more like even like watermelon and stuff that's lower in fructose content. There's no doubt, like Matt and I have been talking about this stuff a lot, is that when you take in fructose upregulates GLUT5 transport molecule in the liver, which preferentially pulls in fructose in the liver, which we've been pretty knowledgeable and savvy about that fact. But what we're understanding now, when that pathway gets upregulated, when that transport mechanism gets upregulated in the liver, fructose stimulating fructose uptake in the liver, it also stimulates glucose uptake in the liver. And so it makes the liver essentially more insulin sensitive to glucose. And so this fructose-glucose combo is a pretty heavy-duty punch. And particularly if anybody has any tendency towards metabolic derangement, then we're going to start seeing hepatic glycogen repletion, liver glycogen getting topped off, and then subsequent fat production from that. And what we see from that then is palmitic acid production. Palmitic acid passes through the blood-brain barrier. That causes problems with leptin sensitivity. It causes a downregulation in leptin sensitivity. So we get this feed-forward cascade that under similar calorie intakes can be very, very different metabolically. And so it's not all just related to insulin. It gets a little bit more complex and a little bit more murky. But in the final analysis, something that folks can do is, you know, pump your food through a fit day or something like that, and track how you do, how do you look, how do you feel, how you perform on a given amount of fruit, and then switch out the fruit and go for more like a yam or a sweet potato. And I think it's more the yellow variety, and I forget even which those are, you know, whether it's legitimately a sweet potato or whatever, but the yellow variety is actually less sucrose than the orange variety. And so that sucrose is 50% glucose and fructose. And so you should theoretically have even less hepatic glycogen repletion under those circumstances. And you should see better leanness. So that's one issue that she could tackle from the leanness deal. And then also the fact that she's on bioidentical hormones, unless that whole setup is dialed in correctly, it's a little bit like when we see females on just standard estrogen or progesterone replacement for birth control. It's hard sometimes to lose body weight on that unless it's really dialed in correctly. And then one more piece to that, which we're going to tackle here in a second, is if there is a mineral metabolism issue, then that could stymie or cause some problems with her fat loss too.
In other words, don't eat fruit, says Rob Wolf. No, I'm kidding.
Try playing with it. Try playing with it. Like, if leaning out is an issue, that's a really simple thing to control that you could play with. Now, converse to that, and this is getting a little bit sideways, but I added just a skosh of coffee earlier, and I'm really hitting my stride here. But if we're looking at some sort of an athletic event kind of thing, or like pre-event kind of scenario, in which we might want a little bit of hepatic or liver glycogen storage so that we can access, you know, maintain blood sugar over the course of time, then a little bit of fruit pre or peri WOD, you know, any type of workout, that might be a smart way to go. You know, and that's some other stuff that you would need to play with. And certainly on long time indexed efforts, you're going to want to do more and more and more of that. Like, you're going to try to feed nutrients into every metabolic pathway you can. Glycogen in the muscles, glycogen in the liver. Best way to get glycogen in the liver is a little bit of fructose plus some glucose, and you're kind of off and running on that. So again, like, not a one size fits all. Need to be a little bit savvy about who we're talking about and what's the situation we're playing with, so that we can dial in the nutrition to suit their specific needs.
Good. All right. And last question. The last one, Christina says she's at a loss on. Her aunt's muscles are freezing. About 45 minutes into a strenuous workout, they lock up. She normally will vary between a light, medium intensity workout. There is no pain or cramping, just a painless arthritic type of locking. You can tell I've had some heavy cream in my coffee, Rob. I can't really talk.
It's the heavy tequila that we really need to do the podcast.
Seriously. She experiences this all over. However, her jaw, legs, and grip seem to be the worst. She has even crashed her bike a couple of times on long rides because of this locking issue. She has always had this problem. However, this past year, the problem has become worse. Thank you so much for your help, Christina.
You know, this third one, doing a little bit of digging around, spontaneous tetany produced. So the first thing that really popped up was some issues with a parathyroid hormone. And so that would be something like, bottom line, like, this is a pretty concerning scenario, particularly the fact, like, I spoke with Christina last night at the gym. This is a pretty concerning situation. So, like, the aunt definitely needs to go to a doctor and get checked out. And it obviously not a physician, haven't run blood work on this woman or anything, but just a little bit of sniffing around, the tetany, the sudden locking, the fact that it's somewhat diffuse, ranging from the jaw to her grip to her legs. This sounds a lot like some mineral balance issues, maybe some hypo or hypercalcemia due to, like, some parathyroid dysregulation. And so, and some of the other stuff that she has going on, like the digestive issues, if we are really you know, constipated, that can be an issue with too much calcium absorption or hypercalcemia, too much calcium in the blood, and then subsequently inadequate magnesium absorption and some stuff like that. So overall, there's a little bit of a picture here that emerges that looks a little bit like a you know, a parathyroid issue. But fundamentally, if somebody's riding their bike and they have, like, a full body seizure, essentially, in which they, like, freeze up and they crash their bike, you need to go see your doctor. Bottom line with that, like, all the paleo diet recommendations are generally pretty good, but an interesting thing in this situation, if she does in fact have some sort of a parathyroid issue, vitamin D could be massively contraindicated. Vitamin D supplementation could make the situation much, much worse. So this is this thing again where, like, you know, general paleo nutrition is, like, a great, you know, shines a big light on a lot of what we do, but we have this amazing, you know, and I hammer on doctors a lot, hammer on the medical situation a lot, but the reality is that for acute kind of wacky situations, you know, you get hit by a bus, you have some sort of a acute situation like this, it's really smart to go get checked out by your doctor and get some you know, some basic blood work done on this thing. So that's what I would recommend, and we'll talk to Christina at the gym, pass this along, because otherwise she's not going to hear about this for about a month, and then we'll see if they follow this up and maybe do a little follow-up on this.
Perfect. Good. All right. Thanks for the question, Christina.
And she's always got one or two lurking in there. So
yes. Next question from Tyler. He says he stays pretty strict on paleo most of the time, but when he does cheat, he really goes off the deep end. For example, after not cheating for 3 weeks, I decided I deserved a cheat day and proceeded to have a huge thing of ice cream and all kinds of other sugary goodness. After letting that digest, I then went and cleaned up half a large pizza. So after binging like that, what do you suggest a person does? Fast, eat like normal, or anything else you suggest?
I don't know that I've really got any suggestions for that. I don't know. You could kind of just do whatever you want to do. My anxiety about any of this stuff, like, I think a bender like that once in a while, like, obviously I'm not going to get away with that because of the gluten intolerance, but I could do ice cream and a gluten-free pizza, and, you know, I would feel somewhat wrecked from that, but not horribly. I really don't have much desire to do that, and so it's not that big a deal. But the thing that makes me nervous about that and any type of a really wacky intervention, like, you know, fasting afterwards or something, is just kind of the potential for some food neuroses to get set up there. And that's where I guess generally just kind of recommend, you know, if you want to go kick your heels up, kick your heels up. And then when you don't feel like crap anymore, then eat a normal healthy meal. And if it seems to feel okay, you know, you're like, oh my God, I ate like 6,000 calories yesterday. I think I'm gonna wait until like 2 or 3 o'clock this afternoon before I eat again. Then I think that's probably reasonable too, but I just wouldn't create a bunch of emotional attachment to it one way or another. I would just go with how you feel, and that would be my only thing with that. You know, it's folks can get very neurotic about their food, and I definitely encourage not doing that.
Yeah, I think the other option for our friend Tyler would be to play with some, we'll say, quasi-paleo treats that would help him not go off the deep end and eat like 7,000 calories worth of junk. Like, for me, if I go and have a pizza, it's going to end up with like just a train wreck of epic proportions, similar to like Tyler. But if I do something like, I want some sweet stuff and I make like the coconut apple pudding situation, mm-hmm. I can eat that. I feel fine the next day. You know, maybe I'm a little bloated because I ate a lot more maybe than I did normally. But then, you know, I feel like for some people, you know, having a candy bar then sets off this chain reaction of like, oh, I'm craving something really sweet. I had a candy bar. Now I'm going to go have some vanilla wafers, and then I'm going to have, you know, some crazy Starbucks mocha frappuccino situation as well.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, like one of my faves always is like the 85 to 90% dark chocolate, you know, that over some, you know, like almonds or something like that is pretty damn yummy. And it just seems like I don't go as bananas on that versus some of this other stuff. Interesting deal on the sense of sweet, though. Like the other day, we've been getting some of the Trader Joe's dark chocolate, lover's chocolate. It's like this 85% dark chocolate. It's pretty damn good. I'll have a little wafer of it here and there. And when I have that just as kind of a standalone deal, it tastes really sweet to me. Interestingly, though, I was eating some cherries, and then I went to, you know, I had some dark chocolate after the cherries, and the dark chocolate tasted like chalk to me. So it was remarkable. Like, that dark chocolate is really not that sweet. There's really not that much sugar in it. When you look at the whole bar, like, there's very, very little sugar in it. So the cherries actually were registering as a much more potent sweet taste than what even the dark chocolate was. So I kind of default to that. You know, Matt Lalonde doesn't like some of them because they have some soy lecithin in them, and the soy lecithin can carry a little bit of some omega-6 along the ride, but it's such small amounts, I'm not that weirded out by it, at least not yet. But that was just kind of an interesting observation. I would not have predicted that at all.
Matt LaLonde is like the bad cop, Rob, and you're the good cop.
Well, it's kind of like hanging out with Scotty and Rochelle. Right. Like, they make me look not extreme, which is kind of cool sometimes. So love those guys for that fact and for a lot of other facts, too.
All right, good. Next, we got a good question from Nash, Rob. I'm excited for this one.
Oh, dear.
Nash says, why follow a diet that you can modify and do a workout that is no changes allowed? Are we living a double standard? I follow you a lot, and I'm just wondering, coming from a fellow scientist, thanks, Nash.
Okay, Andy, you've got to explain this one to me. Nash, I'm not following the deal here. Am I recommending a workout that's unmodifiable, or what's...
The way I'm reading this, and Nash, correct me if I'm wrong and send a follow-up email, is that I'm wondering if the workout that is no changes allowed is sort of a reference to some CrossFit thing. That's the only thing I can think of because I got nothing else, man. I just wanted to put it in there to see if it could spin you out today since you had a skosh of coffee, whatever that means.
Andy D's poking the bear, folks. you know, this is a... I wrote, let's see here, may have been one of the first performance menu articles talking about the zone. First or second, one or two of the, you know, I had one that was the golden ratio and then another one on skinning the zone and a couple other things. But that was always some of my issue about the zone itself. You know, when I was in doing CrossFit much more diligently, you have this highly dynamic strength and conditioning system. You know, it's always changing and trying to evolve and adapt and all that sort of stuff. But yet the answer to it was this completely static, unchanging nutritional approach, which just didn't really make sense to me at all, you know, especially with just a little bit of an eye towards individualization, to say nothing of like pre or post-workout nutrition. And then adding in individualization also, you know, am I carb tolerant or intolerant and stuff like that. And so Nash, send us some follow-up on this just so that Andy can continue to try to provoke me into some sort of on-air freak out. But definitely I don't see any continuity here. You know, like your nutrition should be dynamic and adaptable to what your needs are, as should your training. And you know, thinking about this, you know, there's having goals in your training, I think are great, and like having some stuff that you shoot for and everything, but I guess there's this balance between like nutting up and, you know, like getting hard work done and all that sort of stuff. But then there's also at some point this deal of like, you know, you look at what you've got ahead of you and it's like, does this look fun? Does this look inspiring at all, you know? And I think, you, Andy, you posted something at some point, a Poliquin piece. It was basically like, if you do what you love, then you're not doing any training, or there's not a day of training that you do after that. You know, you just do stuff that you really, really enjoy. And I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. And, you know, there should be some dynamicism on both sides, both the food and the training side. And so, Nash, if we're just off on left field and we miss the point, then fill us in and we'll come back and revisit this thing.
All right.
But fundamentally, you're spot on. Both of them should be dynamic, and they should ultimately make you happy. You know, feed into your happiness, feed into enjoyment, you know, whether it's community or allow you to do things outside the gym better, or if you have some specific stuff that you're really fired up about chasing, whether it's O-lifting or powerlifting or gymnastics or whatever, then, you know, have those specific goals. But it definitely should be enjoyable and not drudgery and not something that you have to micromanage and attack it like an Olympic athlete. You know, if you're getting paid for your athleticism, then that's one thing. Otherwise, why don't we try to make it fun?
It's always fun, Rob. Whether you're getting paid for it or not, that's what I say.
But. Andy, it should be more birthday party than physics class.
Oh, my Lord. I'm just not even going to respond to that. Next, we have a follow-up comment, which I love follow-up comments, because normally we just feel like we send these off into the ether and nothing ever comes back. So I love follow-up. So we have a comment from the mother-in-law of Brendan from episode 31, Nancy. So Nancy says, this is a follow-up to Rob's, the question we got from Brendan about resistant starch. So Nancy goes on to say, resistant starch is resistant to digestion in the upper gastrointestinal tract. Amylose, a resistant starch, is the linear glucose polymer, which should be compared to the branched amylopectin, not pectin. It does not make sense to include resistant starch in the diet as an energy source. It should be included in the diet because it is a so-called prebiotic, which promotes growth of so-called probiotic bacteria in the lower intestine, which provide colon cancer protection, increased insulin sensitivity, improved lipid metabolism, and many other beneficial effects. There are many non-legume sources of resistant starch. One should also be careful about generalizations concerning legumes and autoimmune disorders. For example, soy protein
isoflavones,
thank you, as well as alfalfa seed extracts have been shown to diminish autoimmune responses related to lupus and rheumatoid arthritis. Change to a Mediterranean diet inclusive of legumes has been shown to significantly decrease symptoms of rheumatoid arthritis. I'd be happy to provide citations of recent scientific articles related to these topics if requested.
So I did actually write a response to Nancy, and I appreciate that she responded. I was possibly a little bit snarky, but
shocker.
But you know, when the original question came in, it really wasn't. The question was, what do I think about resistant starch? And in fact, there are a lot of people who, and I did in fact in the podcast talk about the difference between amylopectin and pectin. And I said on there that I never remember the difference between them, just that one of them is branched and one of them is straight. And so I kind of covered all that stuff. So I was a little bit annoyed by that because I covered all of that stuff. And then Nancy's looking at this stuff from, there's actually no digestion that happens with carbohydrates, or virtually none that happens in the upper GI tract. It all starts in the small intestine and beyond. So that starts becoming kind of a moot point too. But we're going to split hairs and we'll just get down and split them all. But there are people who recommend foods that are high in resistant starches, the non-branched starches, for the glycemic load effect, because it decreases how rapidly these foods enter the system. There's a type of lentil, chana dal lentils, I think are what they call, but they tend to be massively non-branched, like they're very, very straight, and they register a very, very low glycemic index because of that, because they're very, very slow to digest due to the enzymatic action on them. But so there are they do function as a prebiotic, and they actually feed into bacterial fermentation that leads into fatty acid ester production that goes into conjugated linoleic acid formation. So there's a bunch of different stuff with this, but it wasn't really clear how this was being presented. So I tackled it from the glycemic load perspective, which is a totally legit perspective. This other perspective with regards to pre and probiotic is also a legitimate perspective, but it wasn't delineated with that. And so I tackled the first one that kind of popped up. And then the deal with the rheumatoid arthritis and all this stuff, I have no doubt that there are probably some extracts out of legumes and maybe even grains that could have some anti-inflammatory effect even on autoimmune conditions. But the thing is that we're not looking at a whole food in this scenario. If we want to start talking plant extracts, and it's a whole different thing. And what I'm talking about, and what we're recommending using this kind of paleo diet perspective, is in fact whole foods, not supplements or some sort of a food extract. And you do a very simple search of lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, and anything related to legumes, particularly alfalfa seeds and different sprouts, and they are completely contraindicated by like any rheumatologist or rheumatology website that you can find. If you were to go into a clinical practice with a rheumatologist and ask these folks about would alfalfa sprouts be an appropriate food for someone with lupus or rheumatoid arthritis, and they would say no. They're pretty savvy to that stuff. So the fact that there are some extracts out of these foods that could have some benefit doesn't change the fact that the whole food themselves are actually highly problematic. So it's a completely moot point and still doesn't address the fact that this basic recommendation of lean, ideally grass-fed or wild-caught meats and seafoods, seasonal fruits and vegetables, maybe an emphasis of denser carbohydrates coming from non-anti-nutrient-containing tubers like yams, sweet potatoes, tapioca, you know, that sort of stuff, would be a wise thing to do for overall health. And until you can show me something that really is quantitatively better than that, then that's pretty much where I'm going to hang my hat on this thing. And that was pretty much the written response that I had to Nancy on that topic.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure it was that calm and controlled.
It was pretty calm and controlled. I'm not a huge jerk all the time, just occasionally. Just when provoked by Andy D's, so.
Well, it's part of my role.
Yeah. You know. So I haven't heard back from Nancy. If she wants to commentate on that, then she certainly can. It's not like I'm trying to, like, strong-arm her. But, you know, it's my opinion on the topic as it stands right now, so.
Yeah, and I think, to be honest, if Nancy's listening, or Brendan, like, I think we legitimately appreciate her opinion and the fact that she took time to respond. Like,
absolutely.
I thought that was really cool, actually. So, you know, if people disagree, like, we're not here to... This isn't Cuba, you know.
Not yet.
But, you know, I like to hear from differing viewpoints. I think that's part of the reason we do this. So I thought it was cool that she responded.
Totally, but I will, if folks respond, if they're missing that I address elements in the podcast, I am going to take them to task on that, and I may be a little bit spicy with that just because I'm busy and I can't reiterate that I've already covered a topic. So if you choose to respond, then, you know, just that, know that I may be a little bit terse in that other response if my feet are being held to the flame that I didn't cover XYZ and in fact I did. So
take a deep breath, Rob. We're moving on.
More coffee.
Okay. I'm sure that'll be good. It's like 100 degrees outside. I'm sure you feel great after more coffee. Next, we got a question from Greg. He says, what are the pros and cons of eating raw vice-cooked eggs?
Versus cooked eggs. Vice-cooked. Pro, you could look like Rocky. And then con, it's just all from there. You know, you've got... legitimate risk of food poisoning, like kind of salmonella, some other nasties that are potentially on eggs, avidin, which is a B vitamin blocker, lysozyme, which is both a protease inhibitor and a gut damaging element. So you get most of the benefit from cooking them. You could soft cook, you know, like a over medium or like a soft boil if you want to leave the yolk intact, but I'm really not even that geeked out on that. But I see virtually no pro to eating raw eggs and quite a few cons.
Amen to that, although it does make for a cool scene in movies, let's be honest.
I'm telling you, man. Yeah.
Yeah, just because they do it in the movies doesn't mean I should do it. Although it'd be cool.
It would be cool.
Maybe we'll video that with our Beyond the with our at the whiteboard video.
I say we feed you raw eggs until we get a batch of them that do have some sort of like a bacterial infestation, and then we film your like purgative action coming out of both ends, and then people are like, okay, I'm good on the raw egg issue. So
yeah, that'll go over well. I'm sure everyone wants to see that.
Maybe we can make fail blog or something like that. So
yeah, I like it. Well, it's performance art. I think Starat would appreciate the vomiting, so we'll have to work on that.
Sweet.
Next, we got a question from Thomas. He says, Rob, I have a ton of questions about my own nutritional needs. What the heck is a rower supposed to eat when workouts vary from 90 minutes of steady state, 70% max heart rate, to 6x4 minutes at 32 strokes per minute in the same week? But this one's actually about my dad. He is a full-blown type 2 diabetic. My mom had tried doing a number of diets to try to rectify his condition, vegan for one, but nothing has had the desired effect. As a result, his doctor decided to put him on insulin injections. I kind of shrugged my shoulders and said, oh well, thinking it might be a temporary thing. I've read a couple of quick blurbs saying that insulin injections will derange his system for life. Is this true? Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, the shorter answer to that is kind of yeah. I guess the best analogy that I have for this is if you've ever seen video, or maybe you've even done it, where you jump in a drunk driver simulator where they can delay your response. You know, like when you step on the brake, there's a delayed response. When you turn the wheel, there's a delayed response, or an overemphasized response. And that's a lot of what starts happening when we are removing our normal pancreatic control of our blood sugar and then relying on exogenous or outside insulin to control things, and stuff does not go well. And part of what doctors are doing, they're diligently trying to control high blood glucose levels, which can legitimately kill people. So their primary concern is make sure this person does not die today. But the problem is it's not addressing the fundamental issue. And so in a critical care scenario or a crisis kind of scenario, the insulin is appropriate, but then we're not addressing the fundamental nutrition changes. And, you know, when folks say that they've tried nutrition interventions, whether it's vegan or whatever, and nothing really has a desired effect, like, you got to ask questions about, like, how good was adherence? How good was other lifestyle factors? Did he get in and start doing some exercise and stuff like that? So it's, in my opinion, type 2 diabetes is pretty much a situational condition. It's a little bit like a sunburn, like you are being exposed to an environmental insult, which is overwhelming your body's capacity to adapt to it, which is dietary carbohydrate and problems that exacerbate your ability to handle dietary carbohydrate, like lectins, like stress, sleep inadequacy, stuff like that. And if you don't address this stuff, then it's kind of a downhill slope. It's downward spiral. And that's really all there is to it. Protein Power Life Plan is a phenomenal book looking at this. The Bernstein Diabetes Solution is pretty good, but I would just look at that through the perspective of paleo foods. I think Bernstein's book is very, very good, but if you were to shift his orientation fully into kind of an understanding of, like, gluten intolerance and lectin problems, then it would just turbocharge what he's doing. And of course, my book will be out in September, so that'll, you know, I address all this stuff at that point too. But insulin injections are not a good idea. There are other ways around this, but you need some legitimate buy-in to get POPs moving in the right direction.
And you need a doctor willing to cooperate.
Absolutely, yeah. You got to have somebody that's willing to help in this whole scene. Yeah.
All right. Good question. Next, we got a question from Matt, and I'm going to read the first part, even though I don't want to. First of all, really been enjoying the show, and Rob, thanks for never letting go of the 6 listeners joke. Matt, seriously, do you have to put that in? And then he goes on to say, Andy, you must be Jimmy Morris Podwin learner.
Andy's come a long way, folks. Yeah.
Oh man, 6 listeners. I just can't. Probably by my comments about this, I'm probably encouraging people to send it in, Rob. So I'm gonna start to leave it alone. I'm gonna turn the other cheek, and we're just gonna see how many jokes we get about.
You know, we're just going to assail you. All the rest of us are going to assail you since you're trying to provoke me most of the time anyway. So.
Well, you know, the favorite episode was the Angry Rob Wolf episode, if you recall. When we recorded in your office, and it sounded
right.
It sounded like it was that scene from Real Genius where they're talking to Kent through the the microphone or the receiver in his filling.
Right.
Yeah, I love that movie. Anyway, so we're gonna bring that back eventually. But moving on. From Matt. Here's my question: can you talk about the processes by which an athlete's sweat can smell like ammonia and how it can be alleviated? I have an athlete who has this problem. She's in her mid-30s, a good athlete, but an endurance athlete. Please note that he says good athlete, but an endurance athlete. There's no bias there. She does CrossFit at my gym 5 days a week. However, we do Wendler's 5-3-1, and I stick strictly to it, vary their intensity levels and length of Metcons. We do Metcons 5 days a week, but 4 of those days, the conditioning can be anywhere from 2 to only 12 minutes long max. My athletes only have the chance to do 1 longish Metcon per week, and it can be between 15 to 30 minutes. I have no idea how much she trains on her own, and apparently she knows too much for her own good, i.e. she's an endurance athlete, so she knows all about nutrition.
Guy anyway, is bitter, man.
Well, Rob, I feel like these are people that, you know, this could be you 2 years ago, so...
I've mellowed.
You're mellowed with age. Anyway, I had gotten her to switch to paleo eating. She was adapting to it and was overtraining at the same time. At the beginning of week 3, she said she started feeling sluggish and then started to smell of ammonia and that was it for her because she couldn't keep training and have her muscle breaking down. She stopped eating paleo, went back to eating her endurance athlete way, oatmeal, wheat bread, and all the other crap, and overtraining. I could write another 5,000 words describing all the coaching, educating, etc. I've done with her, but I'll spare you both and the other five listeners.
Good
so
man.
Please, for the moment, pretend that I've not given her any advice on this matter and share with me the paleo approach of how I could help her to stop her sweat from smelling like a household cleaner. Thanks a million, guys. Love the show. And Rob, I sincerely appreciate all the info you share with we dedicated few.
Very cool. Got to help the five remaining listeners. So, you know, what I think is probably going on here is that, you know, when folks say paleo frequently, the interpretation of that is like protein and veggies. And that is an interpretation, but for a hard training athlete doing some CrossFit and some endurance work, like they, unless they are really wired up that they're very, very fat adapted and maybe there's kind of two things that were going on here, but fundamentally, I think she was eating inadequate either protein, I'm sorry, either inadequate fat or carbohydrate. And so I did a blog post on the zone and athletic performance in which I talk about the bet that Lauren Cordain made to Joe Friedel, the triathlon coach, basically where Professor Cordain said, you know, Joe, I bet that you will get better performance on a paleo diet. And Joe was like, okay, I'll take that bet. And the first 3 weeks were pretty much hell. Joe was like, man, I'm going to win this thing. And then by week four, week five, he started like totally ramping up and set PRs. And now all of his nutritional recommendations are 100% kind of paleo oriented. But paleo, for where it's at now, definitely where I'm at with paleo, it's very carb agnostic in that you know, you get carbs as per your requirements, somewhat similar to just kind of like caloric intake. If you're very, very active, then you need to eat more. If you're not so active, you don't need to eat so much. And I think what she probably had going on was a lack of adequate carbohydrate, most likely, possibly some fat as cofactors in her diet. And so her body was breaking down protein to convert into glucose. And as you break down protein, then you convert it into urea. And you can get a kind of a ammonia type response out of that via the sweat. And so this would have been a fairly simple thing of just upping her carbohydrate. And I mean, it's kind of funny, you know, it's that thing again, we're like, okay, so she's eating more carbohydrate with like oatmeal and wheat bread and all that sort of stuff. You could still do that with yams, sweet potatoes, melons, and berries. And I would argue that, you know, like your acid base would be better, your gut health would be better, systemic inflammation would be better and all that sort of jive. And then you eat protein as per your kind of branched chain amino acid needs to maintain recovery and good immune function and all that sort of jive. So it really would have just been a little shift in fueling. So for a lot of people, just making sure that when they start playing around with this whole paleo shtick, understanding one, that there may be an adaptation period, even if you're eating more carbohydrates, and then of the form of like yam, sweet potato, fruit, and all that sort of stuff. And aside from the adaptation period, just understanding that you do probably, based on your activity level, you're probably still going to need to eat a fair amount of carbs, you know, and that you're going to run better on a fair amount of carbs. And there's a lot of variety within that. Some people do great without much. Some people can do kind of a cyclic low carb deal where they only do a carb load a week. I know the first time I started eating low carb, like years ago, like 99, 2000, right, end of 99 or beginning of 99, I could do jujitsu, I could do capoeira, and I was like protein, veggies, fat, and I did great on that. I had amazing performance on all that stuff, and now I've been getting back into jujitsu, and I noticed like I require more carbohydrate to be able to perform. And it's kind of a bummer because I know from some of the papers on hormesis and cellular aging, the need for carbohydrate is kind of an indicator of some aging process. And so this may be just a light shown on a 10-year older me and or 12 years, you know, yeah, 10 years older at this point. So there may be a little bit of aging going on there, or maybe I wasn't training as hard at that point as what I'm doing now, you know, doing max effort black box, jiu-jitsu type stuff in combination, whereas before the jiu-jitsu was fairly mellow, capoeira was pretty mellow and all that sort of jive. But fundamental thing, there's lots of different fueling strategies. You have to play around and figure out what is appropriate for the each individual, and there's definitely a ramp up on this stuff. But she should be able to do this and not waste her muscles nor smell like household cleaner.
If I smell like household cleaner, that'd probably not encourage me to eat this way.
There's a lot of you too, so you could produce a lot of ammonia, I think, if you set your liver to it. So
maybe that'll be my 2011 goal.
Cool.
Max ammonia production.
I like it.
All right, next got a question from Sam. Quick question, as I haven't been able to find any information for my doctor, your blog, podcast, and the internet in general. I'm eating a pretty much straight down the line paleo diet, apart from one cheat meal a week, which is two croissants on a Sunday morning. Plenty of fresh green veggies, fruits, white and oily fish, and lean meat. I drink 2 to 3 liters of water a day and get a good 8 to 9 hours of sleep per night. I avoid all dairy and everything else that isn't really included in the paleo diet. Further to this, I take 2 grams of omega-3 fish oil capsules a day, a good multivitamin, and 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C. With regards to training, I will train 5 days a week, normally alternating weight days with running days as I try to bring myself back up to a strong enough level of fitness to restart CrossFit. I never train for more than 45 minutes in one day. My running is always kept to a slow jog to keep it aerobic. My weight sessions are moderately strenuous, normally 6 separate exercises each time and 3 by 10 of each. It feels like I might be missing something because as far as I can see, I'm doing everything right, yet I often have a constant sore throat going on and I'm a lot more tired than I should be on a daily basis. Even when I give myself 3 consecutive rest days, these symptoms don't seem to really subside. Have I missed something, or could it be something else that is causing this problem? Thanks.
You know, it'd be interesting to know Sam's age, which he didn't include. And when we redo the website, we're probably going to have a more standardized submission form with like age and ask some kind of standardized questions for some of this stuff so that we can get all the information up front. You know, and I think a couple of podcasts back, Andy mentioned the Primal Mind deal, where her assertion is that like a gluten exposure can elevate systemic inflammation for like 6 months. I haven't had a chance to read the book yet. Like, I'm cut off from reading any other kind of nutrition, diet-related books until mine's completely done. But wait, was that the deal, Andy? You've read the book,
yep,
right?
Yeah. She basically was saying you would have systemic inflammation up to 6 months, I believe.
Up to 6 months. So that's pretty heavy duty. And certainly, I know for myself, if I sat down and ate 2 croissants with any consistency, like, I would be wrecked from that for a pretty good chunk of time. So just as a throwing it out there kind of gig, like, that is an easily addressed item to just like pull out of the rotation. Instead of 2 croissants, do get some gluten-free pancake mix and do that instead. You know, like, the gluten deal is just a huge issue. Like, tackle that, give it a shot. That's the first place that I would look. And then short of that, like, if the sleep issue could be a thing, but it doesn't seem like that's that big a deal. The other thing that I would start looking at is maybe just kind of a generalized like androgen profile, like testosterone, estrogen, dihydrotestosterone, cortisol, and just kind of make sure that your numbers are in good place. Make sure that your vitamin D levels are in a good spot, and that shouldn't be a real expensive spot to jump in at. But I would take a peek at that. Like, I would try to address the croissant deal just as a give it a shot. You know, it's one of those things that's just like sticking out there. Maybe 1 month, go 100% gluten-free and see if that makes a difference for you. But then I would start looking at some under-the-hood stuff like circulating, you know, free and bound testosterone, DHT, and estrogen. And also within that whole thing, like the DHEAS, DHEA sulfate, pregnenolone, like all the upstream markers also. So you can see if you're producing enough, should have a thyroid check in that whole deal too. Like, if there's just this general malaise, then I would start doing a little bit of looking on a endocrine or a hormone level.
Yeah, and my only comment on the whole paleo cheating once a day thing. I think for us in general, if we're going to cheat, whatever that means exactly, please keep it gluten-free for the love of God.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's
you spend all this effort. Yeah, and you spend all this effort like eating clean, and it's like, well, I think you can come up with something that's cheat, whatever that means, that is probably gluten and dairy-free that is still yummy.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just one of those things that's like right out there on the table. Give it a shot. Worst case scenario, a month later, it doesn't really change, and then you could look at some other stuff. But I mean, it's hard to report like how significant the gluten problem is. Yep. I sound like a crazy person, I know, but it's that thing again where like if I didn't consistently see people improve so much by the exclusion of gluten, then I would be a little bit more relaxed on it. But it's that thing where like, dude, just give it a shot, and worst case scenario, it's not really an issue for you. But it's just so rare that I find someone like that. Like I've bumped into a couple of people that seem legitimately like they're just like Wolverine. Like you can drop them off a building and it doesn't matter, and they can eat, you know, pasta and French bread and everything, and it just really legitimately does not change what's going on with them. These same people I've seen eat paleo like 100% clean, 100%, you know, spot on, and they're like, yeah man, I feel really good with this, but I honestly don't notice a difference with the gluten thing. But they're really rare that I bump into somebody like that.
Well, it's like the same people you bump into can work out 3 times a day and still recover
and still recover. Yeah, totally. And both of these dudes are SEALs, and so they've already gone through a pretty gnarly selection process, which shows that they're probably wired up a little tougher than the average bear, certainly much more so than me. So,
yep. All right. Yeah. Good question. And if you play with that, Sam, let us know.
Yeah, totally.
All right, next we got a question from Craig. He is working on going mostly paleo and have lost weight and feel better than I ever can ever remember. I subscribe to the podcast and really feel like I learn a lot from it. Rob, that's impressive that people are learning from you.
It's a lie.
I've had a question about genetically manipulated foods being paleo. Is a banana considered paleo? The bananas that we see in the grocery today are a pretty new food that were developed pretty much just to be shipped to the U.S. Can a banana or other genetically engineered food be considered part of the paleo diet?
This is that thing
philosophical.
Where, yeah, very, very somewhat philosophical. And I think we have a question coming up either in this podcast or the next podcast that talks a little bit about like fat absorption and it related to coconut product ingestion. And, you know, there's this deal of we use this paleo model, or at least I do, to make informed decisions. And there's no doubt that for the most part, our fruit supply is dramatically sweeter, larger, more sugar-filled than what our ancestors kind of faced. And if you go into like a Trader Joe's or a lot of supermarkets now, they have like the personal watermelon. You know, it's like a little smaller than a soccer ball-sized watermelon. That really is kind of ancestrally like about the size that the melons kind of showed up as, like these gargantuan, like 20, 30-pound melons are the result of some intensive farming and a little bit of genetic tweaking. Kind of the same deal with the bananas. And so, I mean, is a banana Satan's food? No, absolutely not. Like it's got some utility. The potassium deal is way overrated, but you know, it has some utility for a dense carbohydrate source for like post-workout nutrition. It's got a good acid-base balance, all that happy stuff. But is it 100% appropriate all the time? No, probably not. I think Dr. Davis on the HeartScan blog had a post about a guy that essentially put himself into type 2 diabetes by eating fruit. Like the dude just went literally bananas on, you know, eating a bunch of fruit. And because now what we understand with the fructose leading into deranged liver function, and then that heading into downstream problems with leptin sensitivity and whatnot, the guy basically produced a type 2 diabetes kind of scenario out of eating too much fruit. And this is a little bit of the failing or the weakness in the original paleo diet book, which was you can eat unlimited amounts of lean meats, fruits, vegetables, et cetera, but that's really not true. You know, like you can get yourself into trouble with bananas and watermelon and all that sort of jive. Like the reality is that you can. And part of this is just somewhat goes back into the food procurement scenario. Like when we were in Belize, the bananas that are still growing wildly down there are maybe about the your thumb and forefinger or something like that. You know, they're maybe about 4 or 5 inches long, pretty small. And you've got to go through a little bit of work to collect them. And we just don't do any of that stuff. You know, the bananas are huge. We don't collect them. We're not expending any energy for them. So to some degree, when and how we use those bananas should kind of reflect our energy needs and our carbohydrate needs, perhaps. And so I wouldn't look at it so much from like, is it paleo or is it not paleo? You know, it's more just kind of like, when does this food fit into our program and when would it be beneficial to us?
Yep. Good.
Good question.
And final question of the episode, Rob. Can you
ding, 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 ding.
That's right. Question from Mark. Thank you for the podcast. I listen to it every week. My wife and I are about to have our first kid. Congratulations. And we've been looking into the potential benefit harm of vaccinations. It has been difficult because the advice seems to be polarized. Doctors think vaccines are great, while people who don't like them say that vaccines are all terrible, deadly poison. I would love to hear your opinion, as you know both health and science. Thank you.
Or at least I make it up. you know, this is a huge topic, and I've done a fair amount of reading on it. And on the one hand, like there's absolutely no doubt that I think at some point the lack of immunizations that we see, until you completely push something out, say like smallpox, like we're really, really close to getting polio stomped out, and then we've kind of had some backslide on that in other areas of the world. And I think we probably are going to see a backlash in this regard, where we have swaths of our population that are unimmunized against various things, measles, mumps, rubella, whatever, and there's going to be some problems. But then that said, is there the potential for some sort of problem with vaccination? Yeah, I think there is. There's kind of a statistical potential of problem with almost anything that we do, you know, any type of like kind of medical intervention scenario. The research that I was following was from this guy that seemed to indicate that particularly like the MMR vaccine seemed to cause some sort of damage to the gut lining, and that was kind of a portal in for the development of some things like autism, you know, some sort of developmental and behavioral problems. But then more recently, what I've been reading is that this guy that did, and I'm blanking on his name, I'll try to pull that down so that we can get this linkage in there, that there may have been some falsification of this data, the gut damage linkage with like the MMR virus or vaccine was in fact falsified. The reason why this would perk my ears up and be interesting to me is that we're, you know, I'm very oriented on this thought that, you know, grains, legumes, dairy may be potential gut irritants. And if there's something else out there, say like a vaccination that could be a problem, then, you know, that would certainly be of concern. Another piece of this, though, that I was thinking was, you know, what if there's some sort of collateral damage in which individuals who are susceptible to gut damage from, say, like grain, legume, dairy, let's just say gluten is a specific example, though, but let's say they're gluten intolerant, which I think pretty much everybody is, but there's spectrums to that. And then what if there's some sort of collateral damage or complementary effects here from both the gluten and the MMR vaccine? You know, what if there's a problem with that? And I don't know if any of that's been researched. I don't know if any of that stuff has been controlled for. There's definitely some truth to the fact that the vaccine media that was popular in the United States had some thiol-type constituents in them, which are mercury compounds. And you know, mercury is just not good stuff. So I could definitely think of some better carriers that you could use than that. But, you know, like I guess if you were to put my feet to the fire and ask me, would I probably immunize my kids, given the fact that I want to travel a lot and do a lot of stuff like that, I would probably end up immunizing my kids at this point with my understanding of what's going on. But I would just feed them a gluten-free, dairy-free, paleo diet and, you know, support their gut health in that regard. I think some of the really aggressive, really, really young immunization doesn't really make sense to me, given the underdeveloped immune system with the kids. I think they would probably do better from waiting later. But it's definitely a really incendiary topic. So I'm probably going to end up getting death threats. No matter what you say on this topic, you end up pissing somebody off. So that's my thought on it, though. And at this point, I would, you know, just given the fact that I do like to travel, like to go to Central America and probably go into Thailand and all that sort of stuff, and would like to bring my kids with me, I would probably end up immunizing them for most of the stuff that's out there.
Yep. All right, good. Good question.
And I know we have, I think, Chris, who is an immunologist, maybe if when he hears this, maybe he can ping in on this and shoot us an email and kind of give his thoughts on this stuff. I'm definitely not an immunologist, so all this sort of stuff is outside my wheelhouse in some regards, but it's versus, say, like metabolism, but I've followed it to the best of my ability, and that's where I'm at with it.
Perfect. Well, with that, Rob, we end episode 34. I feel good about this one.
Cool. Me too.
You were pretty calm, but I think that's okay.
I was only kind of caffeinated, not over. So.
Only a skosh. Well, thank you for your time as always, and I will talk to you next week.
Right on, Andy. Thanks.
All right. See you, Rob.
Bye-bye. Bye.